Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today the theme is sporting genius, and on the panel chairing it is Sebastian Folkes with Phil Walker, Eddie Butler and John Inverdale.
Thank you very much. This is going to be a lot of fun. We've had some pretty serious events, and we'll get a little bit serious, but mostly we're going to have fun. My name's Sebastian Folkes. I'm a novelist, but I'm also very keen on sport. But I have some real experts with me to talk about sporting genius and the history of it, starting with Phil Walker on my left. Phil is the editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly. He played cricket for Essex Under 19. And could have gone on maybe, but the call of journalism was considerable. Though he did get 134...
You said you weren't going to mention
this. Sorry. He told me not to mention the fact that he got 134 against Lancashire for Essex Under 19. He's also a radio commentator for the BBC and for Talk Sport. And he is co-author of a book called The Social History of Cricket. He's also a very good chap. Next to him... someone who has played sport at the highest level, Eddie Butler, who played number 8 for Wales, 16 caps, and was also a British Lion. Eddie writes a very good column in The Observer, has done for many years. He also actually is a novelist, but he may not want to talk about his novels today. He's written a couple.
Oh, I'll talk about them fine.
Oh, he will talk about them.
Have no fear, Sebastian.
I can also tell you, I'm the only person who's read them both, and they are very good. So
I promise I'll try and stop him talking about them, if at all possible. And finally, on the end, John Inverdale, who will be familiar to all of you, I think, as the voice and face of sport on the BBC for... 30, 35 years, a long, long time anyway. Radio 2, Radio 5, Radio 5 Live, BBC Television. Rugby union is his number one sport, but also he knows about all sports, really, and tennis, I think, probably be his second favourite. So I'm going to ask, you probably know, a lot of you, that the reason... The History Festival is here in Chalk Valley is because James Holland wanted to raise money for the local cricket club. So history is important, but sport came first. Important to remember that. I was at a festival last week, a conference last week in Scotland about the First World War and remembrance of it. And we talked a lot about collective memory and a country's idea of itself. Don't we think too much about war? Shouldn't a country also get an idea of itself from its triumphs? And sport, of course, is a great way that people are brought together. So I'm just going to ask you, each of you, in first, beginning with you, Eddie, what role do you think sport and sporting achievement has played in forming Wales's idea of itself?
Well, I think when it comes to Wales, you sort of almost immediately are... not limited, but you get to rugby pretty quickly, and I think Wales is actually quite a clear-cut case of what sport can do for a country. In the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution, when everybody was being drawn from the land into the new coal fields of South Wales, they came as Welsh-speaking rural people, and so the early industrial valleys were populated by Welsh speakers. And that pretty quickly absorbed all the Welsh speakers from rural Wales that wanted to go. And it was for a better life. However bad we think the industrial valleys were, they were still better than the rural communities that were left behind. So in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, you had a firmly entrenched Welsh-speaking industrial population. But the call quickly went up for more people. There were more mines being opened, more foundries, more ironworks, more steelworks. And so there's the great influx from England and Ireland and Italy and Spain began. And so Wales now had to find a new identity, that the Welsh language was now secondary to the English language that really still prevails in the industrial community. And it was simple, that Wales at the same time, just as North Wales, there was an influx of a new population into North Wales, but it came from Liverpool and Manchester, and they brought football with them. The new population into South Wales came from Gloucester and Bristol in the southwest. They brought rugby with them, and very quickly, the Welsh identity was forged through this new sport that was embraced, and rugby became what united the people of the industrial South Wales. So, and it took such a grip.
So, yeah, rugby and singing.
Rugby and singing, and in particular, because the founding fathers of rugby never wanted it to be played by the likes of miners and steelworkers. It was a game designed for gentle folk, and it's now being embraced dearly by industrial folk.
Well, I've seen Pontypool play, and there was nothing gentle about the folk there, I can assure you. John, do you think, as far as England is concerned, that really our identity is one of wishing we were better? I mean, it took us about 300 years to win Wimbledon after Fred Perry, and I believe, I heard the commentators on the World Cup saying, you know, don't let's start to dream because no one can remember as far back as us ever doing anything. I thought, well, it made me feel very old because I can remember 1966. But is it, how do you think it plays for England?
I don't know, I look at so many of the sports that, if you like, we, inverted commas, invented, and the laws that have been invented, which were all alongside the colonialization of so many parts of the world. So I think there are those two things are inextricably linked. Whether it was success on the battlefield or success economically or socially, the sporting element was mixed in there as well. And if actually, I mean, Eddie did a sort of great historical sort of spiel there, I'd almost bring it right up to date now and just say you only had to be in London in 2012 or actually in Britain in 2012 to realise how sport is a statement of intent, political, social, whatever it might be. And immediately after Rio, when we came so high up the medals table, it wasn't true. You know, I went to a seminar with the heads of UK sport and things like that. And the main mantra that they were beating the table was, we must top the table in Tokyo, which is almost, you could transfer that 150 years ago and just say this is about some kind of subterfuge almost. We're going to colonize and subjugate everybody else. I actually wanted to put my hand up and say, why? Why does it matter? Shouldn't we actually spend our money on PE teachers as opposed to yet more medals? Mm. But that wouldn't have been a very popular thing to say at that event. But I just think it has a lot to do with power almost, and almost by default, having power other nations or other communities.
Yeah. Of course, as cricket, Phil, is not, you know, we talk about Lords, the headquarters, the MCC, we still keep the rule book. But cricket is an Indian game now, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And India come over this summer and the games will be divided in terms of allegiance, split down the middle. It will be a 50-50 game to watch now. Half the crowd will be rooting for India and half the crowd will be a traditional Anglo-Saxon English fan. This is part of the beauty of the game today, that its kind of checkered colonial past has brought it now slowly, dragged itself into the 21st century, and now it is a genuinely multicultural game. And it's reflected in the makeup of the England team as well. 40% of the team that played in the winter are of British Asian descent, and it's only going to go one way. If you look at the numbers of cricket playing participants in the UK, 45% are now British Asian. And so the whole makeup of what was once considered to be a quintessentially English demonstration or showcase of what we are in a certain picture is now changing and changing and changing, to the extent that England will be captained by a British Asian, and indeed was 15 years ago, Nasser Hussain. Yeah. And you'll see it more and more as you move forward.
Yeah. So that's the national thing. Now let's get down to talk about individuals, because we're talking about genius. There may be a national genius Brazil for football or something, but probably that's just a vague idea. John, can you tell us what you understand by a sporting genius? Is this just a sort of something to chat about, or does such a thing exist?
I don't know. I mean, I was driving down here today, I was actually trying to think. The nature of genius is, if you were sort of doing a Venn diagram, if you like, and you had the word genius there, genius immediately then goes to intellect. It goes to acumen. It goes to intelligence. And if you put the word sport there, it kind of goes the other way. It goes towards physicality and brutality sometimes. So it's trying to sort of marry those two, I think. And so I was a lot of the immediate names that I was throwing out myself, and I'm sure somebody will say, "How dare you say that?" But I was thinking of the people who do linear sports, for example, like Steve Redgrave, amazing, 5 Olympic gold medals, extraordinary. Chris Froome, you know, unbelievable, Tour de France, da-da-da-da-da. Usain Bolt, you know, ridiculous, fast, blah. But would you really call any of them geniuses? You know, they're doing linear sports which require unbelievable self-sacrifice, extraordinary work ethic, ridiculous pain threshold. They have advantages of lung capacities and, in Bolt's case, physical ability that other people didn't have. But does that make them a genius? Because does genius not absolutely have at its apex the fact that you have to be thinking all the while, not just doing? And you may disagree with that. I throw that open.
Never been done before.
Yeah, maybe you have to be innovative as well. I mean, I could throw a random name out as somebody who was a genius, albeit perhaps in a very minimal way. Dick Fosbury is a man who just completely changed a sport. If you don't know who Dick Fosbury is, he's the guy who, in 1968, decided that it would be a good idea to, instead of going over a high jump bar like that, to go over it like that. And the reason for that he did it was, he was the fourth best high jumper in America. And America in those days, as they still have now, they have a first past the post system in getting picked for the Olympic Games. And the first three get picked for the Olympic Games regardless of what happens at the US trials. The three people who run fastest get picked. Doesn't matter if you're Justin Gatlin or Tyson Gay or whoever it might be, if you're not in the first three, you don't go to Olympic Games. It takes care of all the hassles and the arguments about selection. Dick Fosbury, for 2 years, 66, 67, was the fourth best high jumper in America, continuously, relentlessly, at all the college championships. And his coach, that winter of 67 to 68, they sat down and said, there is no way that you are going to go to the Olympics, because these three guys jump higher than you do, and you're going to come fourth in the trials, and there's one of them breaks their leg, and you will not be going to the Olympic Games. What are we going to do about it? And they sat down and said, right, what could we do? I know. Let's see if we can go backwards over a high jump bar. And, you know, don't be so stupid. Look at it now. Everybody does it. So does that make him innovative? Does that make him a genius? Lucky? I don't know.
Well, there's an element of luck about just about everything to do with sporting genius, because Dick Fosbury went to Mexico City at altitude and everything that was jumped or leapt either long ways or height-wise broke the world record.
But
so his place in history.
But he wouldn't have been there if he hadn't in that winter. Because when he turned up at the US College Championships, nobody'd seen him jump. And then he qualified, and they went, my God.
Yeah. I do think we have to explore the element of the flaw as well. That every sporting genius seems to have something wonky about him as well. You know, whether it's Mozart, who was a spectacularly good cage fighter as well as being a musician. You know, there seems to go with the genius, this, that something is awry. Or maybe it's just that history gives you that opportunity. And I know Muhammad Ali would not be Muhammad Ali if it hadn't been for his civil rights thing, if it hadn't been part of the Muslim Brotherhood, if it hadn't been for Vietnam. And were it not for the fact that he was the brightest heavyweight boxer the world had ever seen, reduced by his very craft to practically brain dead by the end of his life. You know, there are all the ironies and all the context of history that go with that. I'm not saying that's a flaw.
But it's also part of the way that we stitch the narrative together of these particular individuals. So if you say you look at George Best and Paul Gascoigne, who are considered to be, if you like, the two premier geniuses of British football of the last 50 years, people wouldn't call Bobby Charlton a genius necessarily, and yet Charlton's career comfortably eclipsed George Best. But Best has that kind of, that aura, that magic, and that sense of danger that it's all going to collapse at any one moment. And Gascoigne had the same kind of thing. And we want to encourage that in our visions of these individuals in a way that the more straighter-laced, high-achieving figures who have maybe compensated for a kind of an average degree of natural ability by enormous amounts of application, they don't get considered in the same kinds of way. They don't tend to get dropped into that category of genius in the way that the flawed figures and flawed and genius goes together, like bread and butter.
Steve Davis, Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you have it in cricket as well. You know, you had Botham, of course, who was always riding that line. If there is a modern equivalent, then Ben Stokes fits into that category. This is a man who can hit 250 in a test match faster than anyone in history, and yet be tearing out of a nightclub at 2 a.m, and anyone who gets in his way is going to go down.
Allegedly.
You feel with Botham and Stokes that it's sort of testosterone related, isn't it?
Yep.
Whereas, I mean, there are other sportsmen. I mean, Bradman, for instance. Tell us a bit about how weird Don Bradman was. Don Bradman, incidentally, by any measure, is the best sportsman that's been in any sport. The stats will tell you. But a very weird man.
Yeah, just briefly, just on the stats, I'm sure most people know it. It's the most famous stat in cricket. 99.94 is his overall batting average in test history. The next best is 60. So in the history of the game, when you're talking 135 years of test cricket, the best of the best of the best averaged 60. And then there's Bradman, 39.94 down the line, which is mind-boggling. It's like Pelé being 60% better than any other footballer. It's off the charts. I happened, because I'm weird like this, I went to his house just north of Sydney in New South Wales over the winter. And this house has been restored to its former glory. Bradman lived in this house in 1910 through to the early part of 1920s. And it is a study of obsession, this house. Bradman was unquestionably on the spectrum. Bradman was incapable of maintaining friendships. Girlfriends were well out of the question. He was obsessional about everything that he put his mind to. He would practice his cricket with a cricket stump and a golf ball against the water tank outside his mother's kitchen, and he would hit it time after time against this water tank. Now, I've tried this. It's impossible. It's impossible. To even do it once and pick the ball up, it's impossible. He would do it time after time, and there is video footage of this. Meanwhile, his sister would be playing the piano to a virtuoso level. He had to be better than her. He learned the piano to concert level. Meanwhile, the New South Wales table tennis champion is in the newspapers up the road, unbeatable. Bradman had to beat him, so he became a master at table tennis. Beat him. The Australian billiards champion was in Melbourne. Bradman, as a teenager, took the train up to Melbourne and beat him at billiards because he spent 2 years mastering that game as well. Meanwhile, the notions of human interaction had been sidelined. By the time he got into the Australian team at 19, he was already prepared psychologically as well as physically to be the phenomenon that he is.
Do you think, Phil, that Bradman needed the ultimate test, though? You know, you mentioned his average was 99.94. But it's in the Bodyline series, it was only 56.
Yeah.
So he's had to survive that ordeal, and presumably he must have questioned his own talent.
Yeah, he did, and that hit him hard because he was reduced to mere mortality. He averaged what one or two other people were averaging around that era during that series. He then had to reassess the way that he was playing the game in spite of being successful up until that Bodyline series in a way that no one had ever seen before. And yet, he was struck by Bodyline. Bodyline, incidentally, is when balls come at you into the body from a leg stump line and you put all your fielders there. You put all your fielders behind you, so it's impossible to score runs. Bradman still did, but he only scored half the runs that he did in the rest of his life. And he had to change his approach on the back of that.
I know there were fractured skulls.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Very bad.
In the heart.
And questions in Parliament as well. Ongoing thing about sport and politics. Well, you know, Anglo-Australian relations were destroyed for years on the back of a cricket match.
Yeah. I only asked the question because, I mean, for us in Wales and actually rugby in general, Gareth Edwards is sort of up there, almost Bradman-esque, although there are contenders. But Gareth himself had to go through this ordeal on the Great Lions Tour, the one and only time that the Lions have beaten New Zealand in New Zealand. Edwards went off in the first test and Chico Hopkins came on, scored a try and played brilliantly. Second test, Edwards is comprehensively outplayed by Sid Going. And the pressure is on that suddenly the question is raised, shall we drop Gareth Edwards? And the boys go up to him and say, Gareth, your place is under threat here. And in the third test, he just puts in one of the great performances which sets the Lions on track to achieve that
But is that genius?
I asked the question, but...
Was Gareth Edwards the genius or was Barry John the genius? Was Gareth Edwards the man who enabled Barry John to be genius?
Two genii. Let's...
Eddie, who's have you played with rugby with or against a genius?
I did. I played against Jean-Pierre Rive. Remember Jean-Pierre in the great French back row of the 70s? And I played against him in Paris, and it was the game in 1980. It was my first cap, and a famous photo emerged of it where he had this great blonde mane, and it was smeared in blood, most of it by Jean-Pierre rubbing it in as hard as he could. But it was a spectacularly violent game. And Jean-Pierre, to the very end, kept putting himself in harm's way and just... he was up against a guy called Paul Ringer, in my second game got himself sent off at Twickenham. So in the first game, I saw Jean-Pierre Rive covered in blood, and then I saw Paul Ringer sent off in the second game. But one season later, I went on tour, on a Barbarians tour, with Jean-Pierre Rive as a teammate of ours on the Barbarians side. And he just saw things in a different way. He was just ahead of the rest of us. He was going to places that we weren't going to, and he was moving up in defence with an aggression that really, we didn't recognise.
Because he'd seen the map of the game in his head before you did.
He just saw things quicker, and which comes back to whether it's instinct or brain power. Well, I think he thought about that and analysed and... Yeah, I think he was just, call it ahead of his time or whatever. I thought he was a genius.
I'm sure a lot of people watched the France-Argentina game yesterday afternoon, and they were making the point during the commentary on occasions, but it did, watching Messi play yesterday, it was like seeing the conductor, but the orchestra were all half a beat behind him. And there were moments in the game yesterday, right at the end actually, when he actually scuffed the shot, but he beat a player and put the ball into space, the only place in a congested penalty area where he could possibly have had a shot on goal. The fact that the shot he didn't strike properly was a real shame, actually. I desperately wanted him to score. But in that split second, I thought, because knowing we were coming to do this today, I was thinking, was that genius? Was that instinct? Was that just what he does? Yeah. And maybe actually that's what the definition of a genius is. It's just what you do. Without thinking about it.
I remember seeing Zidane the same way playing for France, and he'd pass the ball into space, and you think, why on earth has he done that? And then a couple of seconds later, it became clear. But in team sports, you do rely on your team to be on the wavelength, don't you?
Yeah. It's like that Pelé pass in the 70 final as well to Carlos Alberto, which looks to the naked eye like he's misplaced it.
Yeah.
And then what seems like an age later, Alberto runs onto it from off camera and obviously wallops it in for one of the great goals. And it's described as the most poetic pass ever made, and yet it's just a side pass that you see anyone make, you know?
I've just come back from Argentina, where Wales and Scotland have been on rugby tour, and the great debate in Argentina, Maradona or Messi? And everybody in Argentina said, it's Maradona.
Of course it is.
Which just goes to prove that there is a place for the genius who can survive sport and become a rounded, well... No flaws there.
Very well-rounded.
Yeah.
Yes. In individual sports, a genius is bound to be someone who is selfish and driven. But is it something you know when you see them? I just remember the first time I saw a young Swiss playing tennis at Wimbledon. I'd never heard of him. And he looked like something from a bygone age, and yet... strong and quick, Roger Federer, and he just seemed to be playing a slightly different game.
I wonder how long we'd take to get to Federer.
Yeah.
John?
Well, I think it's really interesting, having just been in Paris a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, Nadal wins a French Open for the 11th time, which is it's staggering. It's how is it possible? That's Bradman-esque to be that much better than everybody else in the hardest era ever to win tennis tournaments, and yet people don't have the he's not Rafael genius Nadal, whereas he is Roger genius Federer. And I don't know if that is that about style? Is that about image? Is that about
style,
look?
Yeah.
Is it about perception? I don't know. I mean, Nadal plays a more belligerent, brutal, physical game. That, by its very nature, perhaps makes it less esoteric. Whereas Federer flows, and he has a one-handed shot, which is by its very nature more beautiful and more aesthetic.
I think Grace has something to do with it, elegance. Yeah. But I mean, David Gower, for instance, he had his critics. But the point is that not only was he incredibly elegant, when he retired, he topped the all-time England batting averages. So brutally effective too. Serena Williams, Billie Jean King, where would you rate them?
Well, there wasn't much elegance to Billie Jean King, but she just dominated for so long and kept it going. I think longevity is important. I think you have to do it over and over again. But I do think there is grace and elegance has to come into it. So to go back to Gareth Edwards and Barry John, I suppose you go Barry John, especially being a small man in a big man's world, that there's the brutality of rugby. I just adore it. But I do, but I have an even greater admiration for the little guy that makes the people that would tear their head off, he can make them look stupid.
Would you say Johnny Wilkinson was a genius?
No.
Why? Because he had to try too hard.
Well, because I could name five.
If Johnny Wilkinson had been Welsh, would you say he was a genius?
Well, no. I can name five Welsh outside halves who I think had more genius about them than Johnny Wilkinson. Johnny Wilkinson was quite a brutish outside half. He was as well known for his defence as he was for anything else, and he was just a metronomic kicker. So no, I honestly don't. Brilliant, but just not a genius.
It's the same with Beckham as well. Similar era, the two of them. And Beckham was a very limited footballer. I remember George Best saying he's had a decent career for a one-footed bloke who can't edit and got no pace.
Yeah.
And this is Beckham, 120 cats.
But maybe that is genius, that actually you overcome such a physical impediment. Like JPR Williams couldn't run very fast, couldn't kick really, and yet he was... perhaps not a genius, but he was pretty close.
Hell of a player. You'd think, if you were thinking Welsh genius, you'd think Phil Bennett, wouldn't you, as well?
I think elegance and the sense of leaving your adversary in your wake and looking slightly silly. I think that's part of it.
But to come back now to this idea that... they're all flawed or difficult or strange people. I mean, we've come up with Gareth Edwards. He's not a strange or difficult man, is he? He's rather a decent guy.
No. Okay, disqualify him then.
Okay, and what about Gary Sobers? I mean, and I just want to drop in here to kind of compete with the big boys. I've actually played against Gary Sobers.
Oh, hello. Yeah, all right.
I have actually hit him for four. It was, he was getting on a bit. But he is probably one of the greatest cricketers ever to play, the best all-rounder, could do anything, bowling, batting, fielding, great stats, an absolutely delightful man.
Yeah, he's probably as pure a genius as has existed in cricket. Bradman, as we've discussed, was psychologically flawed to the extent that he could eke out an obscene career. Sobers did it completely naturally. Sobers didn't particularly practice. He wasn't even massively in love with cricket either. He wasn't an obsessional preparer. He had many other interests, not least rum. I mean, rum was featured very highly in Sobers'
golf,
story.
Yeah.
And yet he could literally do everything. He could catch balls in his sleep. He could bowl every delivery you wanted. He could bowl it out the back of his left hand, at the front of his left hand. He could swing it, he could cut it, and he could bowl quick. And Boycott says he was the greatest batsman who ever walked the earth, including Bradman.
Including Boycott.
As a talent. Apart from Boycott, obviously. Yeah. Apart from Boycott.
But talking about practicing, I just made me think about, if you're talking about tennis and Wimbledon starts tomorrow, you could say the greatest natural genius of anybody who's at Wimbledon is Nick Kyrgios. Yeah. You watch Nick Kyrgios practice, he doesn't practice. Should we do some serves now, Nick? No, mate, don't want to. So he doesn't do it. It was extraordinary to be at Queen's a couple of weeks ago and to watch Nick Kyrgios' practice session. If it's 45 minutes long, he will spend 15 minutes of that on his phone, 10 minutes playing games on his phone.
That might explain why he hasn't won anything yet.
No, but that's what I'm saying. So you could say, so that's, is that natural? That's a natural talent and a natural genius to be able to play at that level without doing the hard yards that everybody else.
No, you've got to win. You've got to win. You've got to win.
Well, they say the real geniuses have that talent, but they also have the application.
Yeah. But Malcolm Gladwell says that you can coach genius. He argues the 10,000 hours thing that we've all heard of. And he uses Tiger Woods as the perfect example. Tiger Woods was on the Bob Hope Show, age 2, chipping golf balls into a net, live on American TV at 2 years old. He had already put in 10,000 hours and more by the age of 10 when he started winning tournaments all over the world. Tiger Woods revolutionized golf because he hit it further than anybody else. He also revolutionized golf because he told you to get into the gym, as we were discussing before getting on stage. So Tiger Woods, was he a born genius or was he coached into genius? Was he coached into taking his particular sport or his pursuit to a level that no one had else ever seen before?
My question about Tiger Woods was, if having sex is a flaw, Tiger won an awful lot while having sex. Didn't anybody say to him, Tiger, go and have some more sex, man, because since you stopped having it, you stopped winning.
Yes, well, there are young children present, I think. So, and I think I see Mrs. Djokovic at the back, too. So, no. That is an interesting... But, I mean, Tiger Woods obviously did have personal problems, but they probably came out of too much fame and too much money, didn't they? He wasn't a bad man.
Is it a problem, you ask yourself?
It's a problem to have.
It's not what I've had to deal with. thinking of other tennis players, I mean, Ostapenko, she is a woman of unbelievable talent, seems to be. Hits the ball frightening. But is she going to do anything, win a lot?
No, because she's too erratic and she sometimes hits it in and sometimes hits it out, which is a basic flaw in tennis, really.
Yeah.
It's not ideal. The thing about Federer is he tends to get the ball in. Yeah. I just think the thing about Federer, which is most... I would love to do it as a compulsory thing in the school curriculum, for kids who, especially modern languages, are not the coolest things to learn these days, to just send somebody, every school in the country, a half-hour Roger Federer press conference. He'll walk on court at Wimbledon tomorrow. He'll demolish, I can't remember who's playing, but anyway, he'll demolish whoever he's playing. And then he will go into the press conference with 250 people, and he will alternate. He'll answer a question in English, and a question in German, and a question in French, and then into English, and then into French. And it is just the most supreme example of commanding a room. And at the end of it, every single press conference I've been to at which Roger Federer has been giving vent to his thoughts on the world generally, never mind the tennis match he just played, at the end of it, you just want to applaud. It is he's as much a virtuoso in that environment as he is on the court. And I've done a couple of sort of corporate days with him where he just, literally, you take him around the city of London and you're in a sort of group of people and they're advising him, and it's like being with a politician, the supreme politician who kisses babies and is engaged with people no matter who they might be. Roger Federer will say, right, where are we going to now? And you'll say, we're going to this law firm. Okay, fine. He walks in and he just literally commands the whole room. He walks in, he doesn't need to be introduced. He walks and says, hi guys, how's the legal world these days? And everybody goes, Roger Federer, he's amazing. Well. And so every aspect, you try and find a flaw in Roger Federer, and like Gareth Edwards, you're struggling. You
Does
really
he
are.
Let his guard down? You'd have seen him off duty.
Yeah, the only time I think you've ever seen, I think you can't be that good without being arrogant. And when he was losing a few games last year, you suddenly saw he started being a bit chippy and a bit more abrupt in his press conferences. He wasn't quite the smiley, charming, chatty Roger. But of course, now he's gone back to winning again. He's everybody's best mate. But maybe that's an indication of the genius as well, the knowledge that,
he's back on the heroin. I'm sorry.
But that's an interesting use of the word virtuoso. Maybe there's a difference between a virtuoso and a genius, but we don't want to get too bogged down. Yeah. I'm just trying to picture Andy Murray giving a press conference in 3 languages.
Just one.
Very tough. I'm really tough. Yeah.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.